This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Black people, particularly Southern Negroes, tired of their oppression, rose up in nonviolent resistance to struggle for their civil rights. Leaders such as Martin Luther King led a grassroots, broad-based, nonviolent movement, which on occasion met violent resistance, but they were ultimately successful because of their appeal to the moral conscience of the American public and the federal government. Later in the 1960s, segments of urban blacks rioted and formed groups such as the Black Panthers. These violent black power groups were not as successful and were ultimately defeated by forces of government. In his book, We Will Shoot Back, Professor Umoja challenges this popular mythology and uncovers a complex, organized history of black resistance to oppression. Dr. Umoja is the professor and chair of African American Studies at Georgia State University, and he joins us this morning. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Umoja.
How you doing, Cecil? How you feeling today?
I am doing well, and I was fascinated and enjoyed your book, and we only have an hour, and so, you know, I'm not sure we can go through 130 years of history, but
300 some odd pages. Huh?
We'll give it a try. So,
okay.
You know, hopefully we'll touch upon a number of things that you talk about in your book. And I thought what we might do is for you to dismantle some of our ideas of the movement and of individuals. So throughout this hour, I'll probably toss out names and events, and maybe you can correct our common understanding of the movement. But perhaps first we'll begin by just sharing the origins of this book and why did you write it?
Wow. Well, I've been researching this book for a while, and the ideas actually come from a couple of different of my personal experiences. I was a student activist in the 1970s, and I came to Atlanta. I was living in Los Angeles, California at that time. I grew up in Compton, California. But I came down here for a meeting, and I asked some civil rights activists to give me a ride to New Orleans. They were veteran activists. One was Walter Collins, who was a member of SNCC, mm-hmm. and he also was an anti-war resister. Mm-hmm. His mother, Dara Collins, was a member of the Republic of New Africa. She also had been advisor to many of the student activists. And when we were riding through from Georgia through Alabama, they began to tell me stories about civil rights activists protecting nonviolent folk.
Mm-hmm.
And they wouldn't be involved in the demonstrations. They would stand on the sidelines with their guns and rifles. And I never heard that before. They also told me of weapons being buried in the country by groups in case there was something that they need, where they would need them at another time. And I never heard these stories. And then I began to meet people. My last chapter is about the United League of Mississippi,
mm-hmm.
and I actually went to Mississippi in the 70s, and I observed black people protecting other black folk and protecting themselves. So when I was in graduate school, I began to research it and write on it in more depth, and that's kind of inspiration for the book. You know, if you said you read the book, and one story I found out early on was my father told me a story. And he grew up in the Mississippi Delta. He was a sharecropper.
Mm-hmm.
He was an adult, and then he was able to go to high school after becoming an adult. But he told me a story of there being a lynching in the town he lived in, Alligator, Mississippi, and him seeing a black man hanging from a water tower. And my grandfather running to grab a gun, and he was going to go shoot the first white man he saw.
Mm-hmm.
But the family tackling my grandfather and disarming him, realizing that they would be wiped out as a family at that particular time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's one hand, I had this ambivalent feeling about that story. One hand, I was proud that my grandfather wanted to fight back,
mm-hmm.
you know, because young blacks, and especially growing up in the North in the West, we were always taught, you know, or felt like our people in the South just took it. And we always said things like, if I lived there, I wouldn't have taken that. Mm-hmm. But we weren't told that there were people who wanted to fight back, that there was this kind of resistance part of, you know, of black culture. Mm-hmm. But, you know, at the same time, I was proud of my grandfather. I understood the fear the rest of the family felt if he'd have responded. So those are kind of the motivations for the book. Mm-hmm. My personal motivations, I think, if an author really wants to do a book well and wants to go into it deeply, you have to have something personal that drives you. And those are kind of my personal connections to this work. I really kind of felt my feeling about this book is I really wanted to tell these stories of people who aren't able to tell them themselves because they're not here. Mm-hmm. You know, they're ancestors now. Or maybe they just don't have the inclination to write a book because it takes a certain type of discipline to want to, you know, get up every day and mm-hmm. do the research and do the writing and all of that. You know, most people are focused in on eating and feeding their families and raising children and grandchildren, sure. You know. So I just wanted to take this opportunity since I had it to let their voices speak.
Well, thank you for that. And you reminded me when you were talking about your family history that I'm reminded that many of us have many of us who families originated in the South, we often have stories of why they migrated to the North or to the West. And we hear stories like, you know, they were troublemakers or something happened or they had to get out. And I thank you for putting a little bit of understanding of that. You know, those events that many of us don't know about.
Well, see, so since the publication of this book, so many people have shared personal family stories with me. I'm really thinking about that being my next project is collecting these stories. Even in my own family, my older cousin contacted me. He was one of the first people to order the book. He got it. And he started reading, and he called me and told me these stories about my grandfather and my uncle that I didn't know. Mm-hmm. And so there are so many of us who have these personal stories, family stories, about our people defying white supremacy, racist violence at that time, and being willing to stand up. Even in my own wife's family, her father was a minister in Virginia. And his first appointment was in Roanoke, Virginia. And prior to him being minister there, black people would leave the first seat on the first row vacant in case a white visitor came. Mm-hmm. And my father-in-law said black people would be able to come and sit there on a first-come, first-served basis. Excuse me, anyone would be able to come and sit on a first-come, first-served basis. And he received a lot of threats from the Klan. He was worried church wasn't going to happen that Sunday. And then he comes to church, and there are black men there with guns and saying, Reverend, we're going to have church this Sunday. Mm-hmm. So we have all these stories in our family. But I think because these stories aren't really told and we don't tell them to our children, our grandchildren, they're forgotten. And then we don't have a real perception about who we are as a people. As a professor, I remember being in a discussion one time and with students from the Caribbean and African-American students, and the Caribbean students were saying, well, we're different because our ancestors fought back. We had the Maroons, and we had slave revolts. But the perception that most blacks have about themselves, and then the world has about us, is that we just took it. I mean, you even see it in the movie Django, where they make Django the exceptional black man. I mean, the other blacks don't even run away mm-hmm. after Django commits an act of retaliation, right? We just stand and watch. So that makes him exceptional. And that was another thing. I tried to write about people, and there are some, you know, well-known civil rights personalities who are mentioned in the book, but a lot of the people were folks who are not well-known. Mm-hmm. One of the things, the best compliments I received is from Willie Ricks, who was involved in SNCC. He heard my book presentation when we did it here in Atlanta, and he said he wanted to thank me for recognizing the local people who mm-hmm. protected them when they were in, you know, the Deep South. So, I think there are names that are unknown that I wanted to highlight.
You're listening to KBOO. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott. We're speaking with Professor Dr. Akinyele Umoja, author of We Will Shoot Back, Armed Resistance in the Mississippi Freedom Movement. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. We'll invite some calls in a few minutes, or you may email us at moretalkradio@gmail.com. Professor, you just mentioned in terms of SNCC and thanking for unveiling some of the events that we may not know. Now, some of us are somewhat familiar with SNCC, and again, the popular narrative is you had Dr. King on one side, and later on SNCC came, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. By the mid-60s, there were some tensions and of the elders and the younger movement members. But many people may not be aware of a group that you talk about, the Regional Council of Negro Leadership. And I think that's important to mention them in terms of organizing in the South. Who were they and why did they form?
Well, the Regional Council of Negro Leadership forms in 1952. And before I talk about them, I want to point out that really the period of time from Reconstruction all the way up to the 50s was a period of time where it wasn't a lot of activism in Mississippi. It was oftentimes shut down. You had the Marcus Garvey movement there in the 1920s, but any time an NAACP chapter tried to form, it was shut down immediately. And when I say shut down, because of economic pressure and because of the threat of violence and actual violence that occurred at different times. But during that time, I would say the black people they built their families, they built lodges, they built churches, they built businesses, and that provided by the 1950s enough resources, and particularly in the Mississippi Delta, in places like Bolivar County, Mississippi, where my father actually was born. But it provided them the ability to sustain a movement. And so you had this group in the Mississippi Delta, rural people, mostly sharecroppers in that area, but particularly in there was an all-black town called Mount Bayou, Mississippi, which became the base for it. You had a black doctor who became the spokesperson for that movement. His name was T.R.M. Howard. T.R.M. Howard, as I mentioned, was a physician. He was one of the wealthiest black men in Mississippi. Originally, they thought he was a kind of like an accommodationist, mm-hmm. because he bought the first park, used his money to create the first park for blacks in Mississippi during Jim Crow. He created the first black swimming pool. And Saturday Evening Post said he was a credit to his race. And I think white people felt, well, he's not trying to integrate. He's all right with us. He's trying to create separate institutions for black people, and they don't have to interact with us. But then he creates the Regional Council of Negro Leadership, and they come out with this campaign, don't buy gas where you can't use the restroom. And along with it, they also promote black entrepreneurship in terms of black people being able to own gas stations. But then right after that, they had a campaign to register to vote. And in the Mississippi Delta, if you had voting for black people, it was almost natural that black people would get political power, because mm-hmm. it was overwhelmingly black. And that's one of the reasons that you had so much racism in Mississippi, because at the end of the Civil War, blacks were in a clear majority. And so just like South Africa, it was a feeling like they had to come down hard on us. T.R.M. Howard's movement, he wouldn't have been able to be so bold in articulating rights for black folks unless he had protection, and he always had a group of armed men around him. That group is also important, along with the creation of the NAACP in the state, and I can talk about that in a second. It is important in terms of the investigation to find out who killed Emmett Till. And Megar Evers, who started in that organization and later was made the the secretary for the NAACP in Mississippi. He, a brother by the name of Amzie Moore, and then Ruby Hurley, who was a regional director at NAACP, they dressed up as sharecroppers, and they went through the Delta to try to get information. And T.R.M. Howard and others organized a group of black men with shotguns to protect them while they were on the investigation. So from the very inception of the rebirth of the movement in Mississippi, the Ebony magazine talked about the new fighting Negro that was born in Mississippi during that time. In 1955, they had this article, and they said this is a person who's not going to be run out the state, who's going to stay there and fight for their rights. But that wouldn't have happened unless people were prepared to arm themselves and protect themselves. Even Emmett Till's mother, when she came to Mississippi for the trial of the two white men who were accused of and who actually admitted to lynching her son, admitted to after they were acquitted, she talked about how in Mount Bayou, Mississippi, when she traveled there, that she didn't have to fear about any invasion because they were so well protected by black defenders there. And I mentioned Medgar Evers. As I said, Medgar Evers, really his first serious political involvement is in the Regional Council of Negro Leadership. But the NAACP decides it wasn't going to be run out the state any longer, and they decided to invest in Medgar Evers as a leader. Prior to this, Medgar Evers used to articulate that black people needed a Mau Mau in Mississippi. And Mau Mau was a group. Really, it's called the Kikuyu Land and Freedom Army, but there were a group in Kenya that were fighting against colonialism, British colonialism in Kenya. And during that time, Megger felt like in Mississippi they needed a group like the Mau Mau that wasn't nonviolent, that retaliated. But when he took this position with the National NAACP, the National NAACP didn't want Megger making these type of statements, so he agreed to be more conciliatory. But he did, even though he didn't articulate publicly about armed resistance, armed self-defense, he did practice it. He always carried a gun, and he would even tell the SNCC workers who came, the younger SNCC workers, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, that they were crazy for trying to practice nonviolence. So Medgar Evers is one figure that we have in our history who usually, because he articulates that change will come through constitutional means, through the use of the courts, he didn't even really articulate the same type of direct action that we know that Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee or SCLC and others were involved in, Congress of Racial Equality. But he did practice on a day-to-day basis carrying his gun, and his widow, Merle Evers, commented that he even tried to prepare, if it happened, for a race war in case that went down. He felt black people should be armed and protect and ready case that happened.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO. We're speaking this morning with the author of We Will Shoot Back, on Resistance in the Mississippi Freedom Movement, Dr. Umoja of Georgia State University. Our numbers are 503-231-8187, and our email is moretalkradio@gmail.com. You were just mentioning Medgar Evers, and again, he's another civil rights icon that we often don't hear that side of the story. You also reference Emmett Till. I was wondering if you could expand your conversation in terms of the civil rights movement by what type of relationship did organizations such as King's SCLC had with organizations just such as the one you just mentioned, in terms of responsible organizations such as that?
Well, organizations such as Regional Council for Negro Leadership, well, they start around the same time. Actually, Regional Council actually starts before SCLC, and it's a Mississippi-based group. SCLC kind of takes a different posture than a group like the Regional Council. Now, there was some relationship. T.R.M. Howard was invited to speak at SCLC functions, and there was a common respect that took place at that particular time between these types of organizations. SCLC took the position from day one that nonviolence was at the core of their organization. They said when they were founded that not one hair on one head of one white man should be touched in this movement for change throughout the South against segregation. Same with Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, started on nonviolent principles.
Mm-hmm.
Congress Racial Equality, which was the first group actually to practice nonviolence in the movement for black freedom, and they started in Chicago. But the difference between SCLC and SNCC and CORE was the SCLC, having the charismatic Dr. King as their leader, usually insisted, if they were involved in a local struggle, that SCLC be in charge of whatever goes down. And people were willing to do that because if you did get Dr. King to get him, involved in your local campaign, then you automatically get national coverage,
mm-hmm.
right? Because
right.
Dr. King is one of the most well-known men in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But when SNCC and CORE, they usually relied more on local people when they organized. So if they went to a community, they went to local people. And most people were not nonviolent in the movement who got active, particularly on a local level. And so they usually had to depend upon local people, not only for food, clothing, and shelter while they were down there, transportation, but they also had to depend upon them for protection. Because, again, SNCC and CORE, unlike Dr. King, Dr. King, as young people would say today, I'm just using young people's terminology, had the president on speed dial.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. King is going to receive protection wherever he goes. And unlike just a college student coming from Howard University or Tougaloo College, they're not going to be able to get the same type of protection from the federal government. Give you an example, if you were to go to the archives of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee or Congress of Racial Equality, when they're in the Deep South in Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, you get, particularly in the rural areas, you get these constant correspondence from them to the Justice Department calling for protection, but oftentimes they didn't receive it. And so since they're getting protection from the federal government, you know, and this is not what a movie like Mississippi Burning would tell us, but since they don't get that type of protection, then oftentimes they had to rely on local people to protect them. Or some of them, in some cases, SNCC and CORE people, picked up guns themselves to protect themselves. So this is part of that reality.
Mm-hmm.
And so over time, they would change. So by SNCC comes to Mississippi in 61,
mm-hmm.
CORE comes in 62. By 1965, both of these groups are embracing armed self-defense.
Right.
And so they really changed. SCLC never really changes on that. Plus, SCLC had a more of a hierarchy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
SNCC and CORE, grassroots people, since they were more democratic, if you will,
mm-hmm.
could come in and help change the policy. And that's what happened.
Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. Let's go to Richard. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, and I want to thank Dr. Ramoja to the max for sticking his neck out and bringing a chapter of American history, the history of human dignity, to light that most of us don't think about. I'm blown away by the fact that you're here today, and I can't thank you enough. I missed a little bit when I was coming in on the phone line, but can I ask you, I want to know about a hero of mine, Dr. King. As a child, he was one of my heroes. Recently, I've heard that he was in possession of quite an array of arms himself. Are you aware of that, and have you talked about that?
No, what I come to believe is prior to Montgomery, did Dr. King own a gun? But after the struggle in Montgomery, and I think his commitment to philosophical nonviolence increased after the Montgomery struggle, that I don't believe he was armed after that. I don't have evidence on that. And I don't talk about that per se in my book. What I do talk about with Dr. King is on the march in 1966, and this is after James Meredith had been shot, when he tries to do a march himself, by himself, against fear. By that point, you know, the Voting Rights Act passes in 1965. And James Meredith tries to tell his fellow Mississippians, look, we have nothing to fear. We can vote now, because a lot of black people, even though the bill had passed, were still concerned about going to vote and registering to vote at that time. He takes the march. He tries to go from Memphis to Jackson, Mississippi by himself. And then almost as soon as he enters Mississippi, he's shot. And fortunately, he survives that shooting. But Dr. King, Stokely Carmichael, all the civil rights forces come together. And there's a debate about whether a group that starts in Louisiana, the Deacons for Defense, should provide security. And the national NAACP, Roy Wilkins and Whitney Young, are against this Deacons for Defense group that started. You know, it's a paramilitary organization that starts and is considers itself the military wing of the civil rights movement. But they're opposed to it. SNCC and CORE want them to be there. And Dr. King falls in the middle, and he basically says, look, they can lead the march and trail the march and make sure no one attacks us, and then they can protect the campsite at night, but nobody in the march should be armed. And that was a compromise. Of course, Whitney Young and Roy Wilkins leaves. Throughout that march is a debates going on about whether black people or whether marchers should be armed or not. And Dr. King debates that with and other nonviolent forces, debate that with some of the younger folk who want to abandon nonviolence at that point. I don't see that Dr. King ever really abandons it. I think he feels like people should be able to protect themselves in their homes, but he doesn't believe that people should have guns in demonstrations.
I concede that, but in your upcoming work, would you take a poke at his inclinations, his personal inclinations to keep what I was informed of was a rather comprehensive array of weapons.
Not to my knowledge. I mean, that might be true. I haven't heard that. I could investigate it even more. I have access to people who are friends of Dr. King here. I know Andy Young said he had a tremendous amount of respect for the Deacons for Defense, but I haven't seen where Dr. King had large amounts of weapons. I haven't seen any evidence to that fact.
Thank you. It's just a detail, but I want to thank you. And is your book available in Portland generally?
I'm not sure. You can order it from Amazon, and it can be ordered directly from NYU Press. In fact, both of them have a 20% discount on the book right now. But if you know of any bookstores there, because I haven't been involved in the distribution of the book or anything of that nature. But if you just have them contact the press, I'm sure they will send them there. The book has been doing real well since it came out. In fact, it had to go into second printing before it came out. It came out April 22nd because it was so much of demand for it, but most of the demand has come online. Since it came out in April, you know, schools aren't using it, won't be using it. Well, the first school was using it this summer. Here's a school down here in Georgia that's using it. I know a lot of schools will use it in the fall. So most of that demand has come from people just seeing it online and hearing about it and ordering it. So it's doing well right now. We had our first book signing in Atlanta two Fridays ago, and it was a standing room only audience, and we sold out all the books we had here.
So, we're hungry for it right now, and I want to thank you again.
Hey, thank you, Richard.
All right.
And Richard, I think you can get it here at Powell's Bookstore in Portland. We're speaking with Dr. Akinyele Omojo, author of We Will Shoot Back, Armed Resistance in the Mississippi Freedom Movement. Let me remind you that coming up here on KBOO at 9 is the OMO Variety Hour. Topics include the global spread of climate change, activism, and a big moment in the struggle against apartheid in South Africa, the Rivonia Raid and its aftermath. At 10 here, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein asks, are we heading for another Dust Bowl, in a discussion with ecologist and geographer Christopher Williams. At 11 on Health Watch, host Dr. David Naiman interviews noted nutrition researcher T. Colin Campbell, author of the China study, about his new book, Whole, Rethinking the Science of Nutrition. At 11:30 on Radio Zine, Dan Johnson interviews George Estrich, author of The Shape of the Eye, his story of raising a daughter with Down syndrome. And also coming up tomorrow on Talk Radio at 8 on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, the topic is TriMet. Guests are Bruce Hansen, president of the Amalgamated Transit Union 757, and Jeff Gianola of KOIN Channel 6, who has produced a series of report on TribeMet. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a member, you can go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Now. Right now, you're listening to Professor Akinyele Omojo, author of We Will Shoot Back, Armed Resistance in the Mississippi Freedom Movement. We have a couple of callers online, so let's go to them. Good morning, Marie.
Good morning, and Professor, I want to thank you for your work, and I have two little points, and then one, a direct story of Martin Luther King on the violence issue about rifles, because a pastor named Pastor David Duncan out here in the Columbia Gorge actually was at Martin Luther King's house. I can tell you that quick story, but there's two little points before that little story, if that's all right.
Okay,
my two little points. The first one, I just want to say, for all white people that have never made amends to black people, that just broke my heart, hearing about the black man lynched on the water tower, just like Jesus on the cross, just as an example of shame and humiliation. I am just so sorry, and I want to just express grief for how shameful this is, these poor black people that have been lynched in a high water tower, just so heartbreaking. And then I have one other little point. Remember, I actually heard this on cable myself. Remember, during the Depression, there were some, these are probably white farmers. They were farmers back east. I don't remember what states. But the banks were coming in, closing down their farms, and a certain amount of farmers got together, and they had rifles, and they went, and they said, you will not take our farms.
That's true.
That's white people. And then I have the little story on Martin Luther King, okay?
Yeah, you could read about that in Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States talks about resistance of farmers and other folk during that Depression time that we generally don't hear about.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think it was Howard Zinn. And let me tell you the quick story. This is a true story of Martin Luther King. I can quickly recount that to you, okay?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Okay. Pastor David Duncan, who is now deceased, who is a great hero of Oregon, a great hero of the Columbia Gorge, he's a great social justice hero, did work with the civil rights movement. He was a pastor. He was a seminarian student at that time. He was not a pastor. And he was actually asked, he told this story at Soul Cafe right here in Hood River, or something about the year 2006. On a Martin Luther King Day, he told the story to a group of us at Soul Cafe. We no longer have a Soul Cafe, but that happened around 2006. I know, it was 2007 or 8. And he said that he was given a rifle. He was at Martin Luther King's house, but they had received many bomb threats, many, many, many bomb threats. And so the story is that they asked Pastor Duncan, who at that time was a seminarian, to lay down under a bush with a rifle. This is at nighttime, and they were watching if someone was coming to bomb the house. And this is an actual story, and it's so sensitive. It portrays the sensitivity about nonviolence. First of all, he heard nothing, and he was almost going to fall asleep for hours and hours, nothing, nothing, nothing. And then around midnight, he did see a big car drive up, or it seemed like a big car, and then he saw this light, and it was a cigarette light. But Pastor David Duncan had an instinct to not shoot, although they had told him to shoot. And you know the end of the story? The end of the story was that light was a cigarette lit by Martin Luther King's son. And Pastor David Duncan said that if he had shot him, it would have set the civil rights movement back so many years, because here was a white person. You understand the complexity? It would have,
right.
And
mm-hmm.
So this is an amazing true story.
Mm-hmm. Hey, thank you
and
so
I'm
much.
I'm assuming Marie. That must have happened in Montgomery.
I'm not sure, but I know it was at his house, Martin Luther King's house. And thank you. What a wonderful program, and I'm so grateful to support minority rights on cable radio. And thank you so much for this work.
Yeah, and I'll follow up on that. Mm-hmm. You know, the historians, we always have to find corroboration for our...
Yeah, it's Duncan, D-U-N-C-A-N, Pastor David Duncan, a great hero who's already deceased now.
Thanks for sharing that with us.
Thank
You're
you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Marie. And we'll go to our next caller. Brian, good morning.
Yes, good morning. And, Doctor, very interesting conversation. And I'm from Florida, and I know that... And I always wanted to hear a deeper discussion about Florida compared to Mississippi, because I know they rate oftentimes higher in racial incidents and racial deaths. Particularly, you know, I really wish people would pay more attention to St. Petersburg, because up, you know, mm-hmm. the last race riot that mm-hmm. I know of was in St. Pete in the 90s, in the late 90s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, it was just like... And there were some great black leaders down there. You know, I wasn't, you know, growing up there as a kid, you know, and not being good with names. I'm
Joseph
not
Wilder, who's still an activist today down there in St. Petersburg.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just
had a group called JOMO, Hunter Militant Organizations. But you also, in St. Augustine, Florida, had a very dynamic movement that actually Dr. King was involved in, mm-hmm. and then the local people there did use armed self-defense.
I think Florida's a role. I mean, you know, not it at least rivals Mississippi in violence, and you know, it's probably a legacy in Florida people don't look at, but I think it's important that we do. But anyway, thank you for the conversation.
Oh no, thank you. And there's a recent book by Tana Reeve-Dew, who's a novelist, Tanana Reeve-Dew, and her mother, who's now deceased, and I'm looking it up. But they wrote a book on the civil rights movement in Florida. Her mother and father were activists in Florida. In fact, I'm going to be working with that family to try to document some of their experiences. But the mother and the daughter have already come out with a book on the civil rights movement in Florida. And before we end, I'll give you the name of that text. It's very good. I just met with the family a couple of weeks ago.
Well, thank you very much. And again, you know, everything brought to light about this subject, I mean, you know, we need to acknowledge it. And, you know, I really want to say this. I'm going to say it every chance I get. Is I want to see a president apologize and propose reparations, and that's it. Thank you, sir.
That would be an objective, and I agree with you. People usually think about reparations for slavery, but, you know, there were damages that were created even through the Jim Crow period. The book I was telling you about is called Freedom in the Family, A Mother and Daughter Memoir of the Fight for Civil Rights, and it really looks at the movement inside of Florida.
Well, thank you very much, sir, and all good fortunes to you.
All right, thank you, sir. I appreciate your words.
Goodbye now.
Take care.
Thank you for calling. Our number is here, 503-231-8187. We're speaking with Professor Umoja of Georgia State University, author of We Will Shoot Back, Armed Resistance in the Mississippi Freedom Movement. We have another caller. Bob, good morning.
Good morning. I read the book last week, and I really liked it and got a lot out of it. Thank you very much.
I appreciate that.
One or two questions stayed with me through the book, and I was wondering if you could address them. One is, I noticed you capitalized white throughout the book.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's usually a designation for a people or a nation. I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Yeah.
And the other question that stayed with me was how you would respond to Isabel Wilkerson's work
Oh, yeah.
The stories of people who left. I'll take my answer off the air.
Very good. Well, I capitalized white, really, to parallel. If you notice, I also capitalized black. And I came up during the 60s, and I usually feel disrespected as a person of African descent when I see black used, and it's with a lowercase b. Any other ethnicity, I don't just see black people as a race, but we are people with a culture, a common history, a common way of speaking and eating, and, you know, even though there are variations and we're not homogeneous, that's true. But and I wanted to make it consistent. I didn't want anybody to read that and say, well, he's capitalizing black, but he's not capitalizing white. So they would think that I was saying something about white people being inferior or something of that nature. So I just tried to make it parallel. I'm glad you mentioned that and caught that. In terms of the book by Dickerson, I'm trying to remember the name of it, that talks about migration. She's a journalist, and she covers three specific black people and the different experiences of migrating north. It's an excellent book. I think the migration story, the great migration that occurs, is very complex, and we haven't really talked about the impact that had on black folks leaving the South, traveling to different cities, but also the impact that had on American society overall. I think on one hand, it probably diluted black voting strength to some places in the South where there were, excuse me, clear majorities. But on the other hand, I think having blacks with being able to vote in Detroit, Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, that impacted the civil rights movement because congressmen and legislators in the North became more sensitive to black issues when blacks were in the North. And so I think that's an excellent book. I would encourage anybody to read it. I think it's The Warmth of Other Suns is the title of that book. Great book.
Thank you, Bob, for calling. Before we go to our next caller, I have a pretty broad question, and you can approach it any way you want. In terms of women in the movement, so that's just broad in terms of sometimes armed resistance, and I think you in the conclusion of the book you mentioned a historian, Simon Wendt, who said black power, armed resistance, existed as a gender symbol of male psychological empowerment.
Right.
You have a broader analysis than that, I think.
Yeah, I challenge that notion. Well, number one, I think he argued that that after 1967 that there was no longer need for black self-defense groups. And I think he was really looking at groups like the Black Panther Party and saying that that was mostly symbolic and that there was no need for black self-defense groups because of federal intervention by that point. So he said most of the self-defense that takes place after 1967 was because of black male ego and psychological needs. But one of the things I demonstrate is, well, after 67, there are Ku Klux Klan type organizations attacking black communities. There are Knight Riders, things of that nature. And the people were still trying to kill black folks and intimidate us. And so there was a need. And that's maybe something Mr. Wendt or Dr. Wendt missed in his examination of black people in self-determination or self-defense in the South. And throughout the United States, because he's speaking about throughout the United States at that time. And, of course, you know, many of us know the case of the five anti-Klan organizers that were murdered in 1979 in Greensboro, North Carolina. And so that really kind of showed, and I showed during that same time, blacks being able to ward off the Klan in Mississippi. And, of course, there were other places, too, through armed self-defense. Which I argue kind of changes the dynamic in several communities. It gives people the confidence to be able to participate politically and challenge this type of fear and intimidation from the Klan and other groups. Now, in terms of women and gender, I think I argue that women were intimately involved in self-defense
at the beginning of the movement, and particularly in the 1960s. When you have groups like the Deacons for Defense, it's usually kind of a shift where it becomes almost exclusively men's jobs to protect the community, but you still have women involved in carrying weapons and things of that nature and involved in defense later. So, but there were women involved. I have a story, really, one of my favorite stories in the book is of this 86-year-old grandmother in Tallahatchie County, Mississippi. Tallahatchie, many of your listeners might remember, is where the Emmett Till lynching, or where Emmett Till's body was found. And this is in 1964, and when Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee came there, and they would organize contingents of people to attempt to register to vote, and you would have to go down to the county courthouse. It's not like today where you could, you know, register at the grocery store or at the bank, but you had to go down to the county courthouse, and usually when blacks, if word got out, blacks were trying to register to vote, they would meet a mob, and that's what happened in Tallahatchie. When they went to the county seat, which was called Charleston, they were attacked, and then night riders came the following week to harass the people who went to go register to vote. So this 86-year-old grandmother, Janie Brewer, who was housing many of the civil rights workers, she got her grandchildren and her children and other neighbors organized, so when the night riders came back to follow the people who went to register to vote, they were met with black folks with guns. The night riders left. It's daytime, so they leave, and you know what they're going to do. They're going to come back at night, right? Mm-hmm. And when they come back, she had this plan where she hid people in the cotton fields, and they were hidden there with guns to ambush the folk. And then she was in her house making Molotov cocktails. So when the night riders come up to her house, they flash a big floodlight on them to distort them. People come out of the cotton fields with their guns and surround them. And then she comes out of her house, if you can imagine, an 86-year-old scrawny woman with gray hair comes out of her house with a Molotov cocktail getting ready to hurl it at them. And then they turn around and leave. So that's one story that shows the women were very much a part of this defense thing. But as the groups like the Deacons started, and I'm not using this to attack the Deacons, I'm just, this is my observation, that it becomes more the role of the men. And then the rhetoric of the movement is that you black men need to step up and protect your women and your children. Mm-hmm. And so it's more assumed that it's the job of males to be involved in the self-defense thing. There are gender dynamics to this story, but you can't forget, and historians can't forget, that people were trying to kill them. It's not just, it wasn't just Symbol, and it wasn't just black men trying to be macho. Mm-hmm. It was about protecting. The primary motivation is protection.
And we have a couple of more callers. We'll try to get them in before the end of this hour. Let's go to our next caller. Joe, thank you for waiting.
Good morning, Professor.
Thanks, Joe.
I was watching a show on PBS a couple of years ago. It might have been one of the installments of the Eyes on the Prize series. And an older black gentleman who appeared to be maybe in his mid-70s said that during the era of the Freedom Riders, he had been part of a shotgun-toting group, defense group known as the Black Lions. I'm wondering if you know anything specifically about the Lions.
Never heard of it. I would try. And that was in what state?
I think it was Mississippi.
I never heard of that, but it wouldn't surprise me. There was also, you know, I got what I could find, and I studied it pretty hard and deep, but I never heard of the Black Lions. Of course, you know, you had the Black Panthers, which actually started, the first Black Panthers are in Alabama, but never heard of the Black Lions.
Okay, but thank you, Joe. And Sean, you're on the air.
Hello. It seems like the violence today is much more subtle. You have violence flowing down the hierarchy of power. Seems mm-hmm. like the normal state of affairs are things like mass incarceration, early death from preventable disease. I was wondering if your guests could comment at all on this notion of violence flowing down the hierarchy and how once violence starts going up the hierarchy, then real change starts to happen. Thanks.
Well, I would say this, that it there is mass incarceration, there is economic violence, and there's a high violence of, you know, lack of health care, things of that nature. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's still a violent situation. I think we live in more of a Matrix-type reality. One group, the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, documented that last year that there were 313 deaths of black people in the United States from police, from vigilantes, or from security guards. That's one for every 28 hours. They did a study first from January to June of 2012, and it was every 36 hours, and that became a slogan that even some rap artists and other activists began to mention. But when the year ended, it was every 28. So it's still a problem of violence in this country, whether it's, you know, the case we all know Trayvon Martin. Mm-hmm. And some people will argue, well, black folks are killing themselves. And that's true. You know, and what we would say is there's still a lack of value for humanity of African descent. And so whether it's black people, black-on-black violence, or it's coming from police, it's still an epidemic where black life is not valued in this country, and authorities don't treat our lives as they treat other human beings. Ella Baker said, until the killing of black sons is important as the killing of white people's sons, then we who believe in freedom cannot rest. And I still have that mm-hmm. as a motivation. You know, our lives are not valued. The places where we live are not valued, and that gets to the type of hierarchical violence that he mentioned. What I would say is I would not say that we have to engage in violence to change reality, but we have to be willing to challenge society and be willing to challenge it and use means that might even be disruptive to challenge to get things changed. Oftentimes, that was something that happened during the civil rights movement when you had the sit-ins. That wasn't particularly violent. They stopped business as usual, and they got changed from that. And you know, without that capacity in a political movement, you sometimes don't get changed. So I would agree with that particular perception that you need to have a capacity to stop business as usual from happening.
And talking about stopping business as usual, we're coming close to the end of our hour. We're speaking with Dr. Akinyele Umoja, author of We Will Shoot Back, Armed Resistance in the Mississippi Freedom Movement, published by NYU Press. It's a great book telling a story that many of us are not aware of. In the last minute or so, Dr. Umoja, what do you think are some of the lessons we can take from reading the book?
Well, one of the things, and I mentioned right at the outset, is I'm hoping that the book will allow people to see black people differently, will allow us not to see that our movement utilize armed self-defense and we utilize more than nonviolence, but the black people were so determined to defend their communities at that particular time. And again, there's a perception that we just kind of took it, and the people who did this, you know, who did fight were exceptional. And I hope the book changes our perception that was the case. I want to say one other thing. When I talked about people being willing to pick up guns to defend themselves, I found cases in my book where black women were taught to use guns by their parents mm-hmm. so they can defend themselves from white racists. Usually during the time I'm writing about, young people, particularly in rural areas, learn how to use guns from their parents.
Yes.
But today, and I, you know, as I mentioned, I grew up in Compton, California in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
I saw the rise of the Crips and Bloods. There was also a proliferation of gun access to guns. I won't even call it gun ownership because a lot of the access was illegal in our communities. And that kind of shifted the game, so to speak. And I know there's a lot of talk of legislation today, and some of the legislation is correct and needs to be supported. But on the other hand, I don't think that'll change this dynamic in our community. What's necessary is entrepreneurship, education, access to employment, strengthening of black families, and that's what will change this dynamic. A love and appreciation for our history and culture. These are the type of things which I think will end and stop the violence in the black community.
Hey, thank you, Dr.
And destabilizes our community. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Umoja. We have to have you on again and hope your book tour will take you here to Oregon. We've been speaking with Dr. Akinyele Umoja, author of We Will Shoot Back, Armed Resistance in the Mississippi Freedom Movement, published by NYU Press. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott. Have a great day.
Take care, Cecil. Thanks a lot.
You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. The time is 9 o'clock. Up next is the Old Mole Variety Hour. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com. This program has also been made possible in part thanks to Merrillhurst University's new Bachelor of Arts in Media and Film Studies, where you can explore how media in all forms affect not only how we view the world, but how we shape it. You'll learn the power of media and how you can use that power to become a participant in change. Now accepting applications. Details at merrillhurst.edu/KBOO.
Well, I wish I was a mole in the ground. Wish I was a mole in the ground. Find a mole in the ground and root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. This is KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, and it's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Clayton Morgridge, hosting today's show, and Joe Clement is here doing the engineering. We are a show about radical social and political change, change that goes, like the mole, to the roots of our dysfunctional society. Roots that lie underground, invisible to the mass media that serves the interests of the corporate press. The mole is the image of ordinary people working to create a society and a world that welcomes our desires for love, solidarity, and freedom. On today's show, we'll be hearing about two mass movements towards a world we can live in, the current and growing movement to wake the world up to the radical changes necessary to prevent catastrophic climate change, and the struggles of South Africans in the 1970s to take their country away from white minority rule to end apartheid. I'll have some reflections on how just waking up to the amazing existence of this world might move us to preserve and cultivate it. And our well-read Red, Fran Michel, will have some well-chosen words about the case of former Black Panther Asata Shakur and her placement 40 years after her alleged crime on the FBI's most wanted list. You can hear this show again on the KBOO website by going to kboo.fm and entering Old Mole Variety Hour in the search box, or become our friend on Facebook. Today's show will be available later this week. Well, Lewis and Clark sociologist Bruce Podobnik has been doing research on the spread of environmental activism, and here's the Old Mole's Bill Resnick to talk with him.
Bruce Podobnik, welcome to KABU.
Well, hello. Thanks for having me.
Bruce Podobnik teaches at Lewis and Clark here in Portland. His specialty is the sociology and politics of climate change. His book is Global Energy Shifts, Fostering Sustainability in a Turbulent Age. And he's an engaged intellectual involved in the struggles to save the planet by organizing to construct an alternative, clean, sustainable, productive system. Recently, he's been doing an analysis of climate change activism around the world. Bruce, tell us about your study and what you found.
Yeah, well, it's an ongoing study. I've basically, with the help of some students, we run computer searches on these newspaper databases, and we pull up any article that talks about protests and climate change. And I'm doing an analysis of the period from the year 2000 until the present of the global spread of activism around climate change. And currently, I've got information on about 8,500 articles that deal with climate change activism. So I've kind of examined like where in the world these protests have happened, what kinds of tactics have been involved, and so on. So it's a pretty comprehensive analysis of where people are engaging in activism around climate change.
Talk about your findings. What are the most interesting findings?
Well, I would highlight a couple of things. The first thing that is interesting is the number of protests that are happening around the world about climate change. It's definitely the case that people around the world, from affluent countries like England and the United States to more impoverished countries like India, are really engaged in this issue. People from all walks of life are concerned about climate change. They're experiencing the effects of climate change in their daily lives, and they're actually organizing with their communities to get involved to try to push companies and political leaders in new directions. So I was quite impressed at the number of protests that have been happening. The other thing that's very interesting is that the protests themselves are actually not just people giving speeches or sending emails, but they're actually physical protests, people actually getting out on the streets. And some of the protests are quite radical. People have, for example, in England, on repeated instances, they've actually broken into airports and climbed on top of airplanes to try to prevent the expansion of airports. In Australia, they've repeatedly broken into coal terminals to try to prevent the expansion of coal trains and coal shipments. And of course, in Alberta, Canada, there have been a number of protests around the tar sand projects to try to bring to light the fact that if these resources get developed, then it's toast for the environment. So I'm quite impressed.